Hi everyone, welcome to the summer series of the Quest Podcast. I'm your host, Todd Fisher. I wanted to give a special introduction to these four episodes. This has been a busy travel year for me, so this short season 5 was recorded during those travels. I warn you, some of these recordings are on location, on a train, the beach, other outdoor locations, so it's a little rough in a few spots, but I really enjoyed these people and what they had to say in their interviews. All four episodes are available now. Thank you for listening, and look for season 6 coming soon. Life is a quest for logic and reason. It is a quest to find balance between science and faith. Life is a quest for knowledge and understanding. But most importantly, it's a quest for personal discovery. Whatever your quest, knowing yourself is the beginning of all wisdom. Welcome to Quest. Hi, everyone. Welcome back to the Quest Podcast. I'm your host, Todd Fisher. And with me today is my perennial guest, Father Daniel DePlanis. Welcome back to the show, Father Dan.
Thank you, Todd. Always a pleasure to be back.
Yeah, this is like probably like your fifth appearance on my podcast. I always love to have you. We always get in some interesting discussions.
I'm a man of many hats, and so it's always good to get into, you know, different perspectives, especially, you know, through the lens of the priesthood and religion and, you know, such things.
Well, this is season 5 of Quest, so I've made it a long way. I'm really proud of this podcast. This is the one that spun off all the others, you know, yours and Amber's, have all kind of, you know, all evolved organically from the very first one I produced in a way. So I'm really proud of this team of just, you're a broadcaster in general, as you said, a man of many hats. So yeah, we've had a big year. Like, you know, this episode is airing in the fall and you put out a book this year that sold really well. We're still getting reviews. We're still getting sales. How do you feel about that?
It's just been surreal, you know, to think about the process start to finish of just writing the book and now to actually have it on sale. And, you know, I'm seeing, like, you know, something that I created on the internet, on Amazon and Barnes and Nobles, these kind of, you know, big name stores. And it's like, holy cow, you know, and people are asking for signed copies. The reviews have been phenomenal. I'm really just astounded at how many different people are reading this book and then getting something out of it. You know, I've had religious people, but not martial artists, read it. I've had martial artists who are not religious read it. And everyone seems to be able to get something out of it, which to me is really fantastic to think that I was able to put something out like that really contributes. You know, this is, I guess you could say, my mark of mastery as a martial artist, is to kind of synthesize everything that we do, both in martial arts as well as being a Christian.
I want to talk about it for a minute because, you know, we announced your book on your podcast, your first, I think your first episode of season 2, we announced your book.
Right.
And we never talked about it in season 4 on mine. So let's take a minute and just let's tell my listeners a little about your book, what it's called, what it's about, just so we can kind of get my listeners up to speed on it.
Yeah, absolutely. The book is called Jesus in the Dojo, A Christian Pedagogy of Martial Arts. And so the book is really kind of, you know, a lot of it through personal lens with my own experience. But the idea is to help to defend and explain how can a Christian practice martial arts, things that we should do that maybe help deepen our faith from a martial arts perspective, but at the same time, things in the martial arts world that we should avoid doing that would be detrimental to our faith. And so this is really kind of going into a lot of Thomas Aquinas's natural law theory, principle of double effect, just war theory, and then also just kind of synthesizing some major tenets of Christian belief, things like the Beatitudes, the Ten Commandments, certain occult practices that we should maybe avoid as Christians that tend to kind of work their way through with martial arts, especially the ones that hail from the Far East. And so it's been just a great project, you know, it kind of is my life's work as both a Catholic priest and a martial artist.
Yeah. And that's what, you know, drew me to it. Our, one of, you know, our initial conversations well over a year ago about this
and just sort of thinking about, and it was honestly probably one of our first topics when you were a guest on the show the first time was, you know, how can you be a priest and a martial artist? Like, you train to be a martial artist, you can kill a person. Like, how does this, this was the thing, this weird balance. And it all came together perfectly in this book. And I couldn't be more proud to be the publisher of it, but I wanted to make sure that we talked about it a little bit on Quest because it hadn't come up, you know?
Yeah.
But yeah, great. It's a great book. Everyone go to metacortexpublishing.com and order a copy, or you can find it wherever you shop for good books. And I'm sure, Father Dan, this isn't the last we'll be talking about this book, because I believe we have an ebook coming out over the holidays and then an audio book for next year. So,
oh yeah, the whole rollout's been, yeah, the rollout process has really just been, you know, fun to think about. And I'm just kind of, you know, enjoying this book and maybe starting to think of another book to write. So, you know, we'll see what happens in the future.
I hope so. I hope so. Well, let's segue over to today's episode. I've wanted to talk about this for a long time. And for some reason, we get tripped up and we don't ever get to talk about this because something happens, like there's a huge news story and we want to talk about that, or something else comes up. And I just keep, this stays on the top of my list, and that is a crisis of faith. And it's something I've wanted to talk about for a long time because I think a lot of people experience this. I've experienced this. Amber's told me she's experienced it. I think this is a common thing, and I want to talk about what it is and how you deal with it. So for the listeners, just, you know, the Cliff Notes version of a crisis of faith is really, it's a deep and painful questioning or loss or transformation of belief. How do you define crisis of faith, Father Dan?
Yeah, I guess really along the same lines as that. You know, I think a big part of a crisis of faith is really when we start questioning, first of all, whether or not God even exists. And even if we do still believe that he exists through, you know, difficult or traumatic experiences, questioning his goodness, perhaps. You know, I think a lot of people, they still believe in God, you know, and whether it be through tragedy and family, sickness, death, things of that nature, or just things that we see in the news media, all these different tragedies that arise. I think sometimes a lot of people, they still believe in God, but they're either angry at God, or they question his benevolence. They question, you know, which translates literally from Latin to mean full of grace, you know, or full of goodness, really. Sure. You know, and so they question whether or not God is really all good. And how could, a lot of the time the question that gets asked in light of that crisis of faith is, how could a God permit X, Y, or Z to happen?
Right. Right. Do you deal with people often with a crisis of faith? Do you talk to people about this?
Oh, all the time, you know, and that's been in every single assignment that I've been at, you know, whether it be at the college campus where I was first assigned as a priest. And then, certainly in the midst of COVID, you know, I think COVID was perhaps one of the greatest sources of crises of faith for a lot of people, or certainly, you know, reminding them of their mortality and question, you know, where is God in the midst of all of this? And so that was right at the onset of my ordination. And then even here being at the cathedral in my diocese, you know, I do a lot of ministry to the elderly, to hospital patients as well. There's been a lot of times where I've had to anoint people in the hospital and they've died right in front of me, you know? So certainly, you know, helping with family and friends to deal with these situations, many of them do experience some kind of crisis of faith in the wake of these kind of tragedies.
Do you feel that a crisis of faith is emotional suffering, such as, you know, feelings of grief or despair, or is it just, you know, thought? I'm thinking about it. I'm trying to rationalize it. I'm using science. You know, is it something like that? That type of questioning, or is it more emotional? Do you feel?
I think it's pretty all encompassing with a lot of those things. You know, I think certainly a lot of people, you know, if they're in a crisis, they will certainly feel it. You know, there are certainly natural emotions that are attached to perhaps the sense of despair. When you think of the word crisis, you know, I often think of people who either despair or just some, maybe just anxiety, fear, just a lot of these emotions that kind of come up when people are experiencing different kinds of crises. And at the same time, you know, definitely, I think there is a lot of rationalization. You know, I think when people have a crisis of faith, there's a bit of a grieving going on. And as you know, you and I both know, grieving is a process. There are several stages to it. And so I think in light of that, you know, people, when they have a crisis of faith, they're in a sense grieving, and they're going to go through the natural phases of that process, you know, denial, anger, bargaining, you know, all these natural phases that come up through the grieving process.
Right. Now, as a priest, how do you address this when someone comes to you with a crisis of faith? I mean, there's probably not, you know, a playbook you have to refer to with it. How do you get a person back on the track of believing in God and or God's goodness or whatnot?
I think a lot of the time is first and foremost, just listening to what's going on, you know, because if they're calling me, if they're calling my office and they're asking, you know, or they're saying to my secretary, hey, I'm in a bit of a pickle. I'm really just having a hard time or a crisis. I really need to speak to a priest. You know, that means they're searching. They're searching for answers. You know, that's often how they find me. Is they're searching for answers already. They're looking for something. And so obviously, if they're coming to a priest, what that tells me is that there's already at least some kind of level of belief. You know, there's some kind of sense in which, you know, if they didn't believe at all, if they had completely lost faith by that point, they wouldn't be asking for a priest. Perhaps a therapist or a psychologist, you know, but if they had lost faith entirely, they wouldn't be coming to a priest. And so if they're coming to see me already, you know, then I have really something to work with, you know. And so let's say they come into my office, you know, and I'm aware already that at least something has happened. And so the first thing I typically do is sit them down in my office and to ask them, you know, tell me exactly what happened. You know, I think one of the first important parts of getting somebody through a crisis of faith is simply to let themselves be heard, you know, because I know for some people, they may not know exactly how to think or what to think or even how to feel about that crisis until they actually get to tell somebody, you know, and oftentimes there's this prerequisite trust that this person, priest in front of me, is qualified and is trained to help me sort through this. And so that's why they often come in and feel comfortable at least saying, hey, look, you know, just you're not going to be judged. Just go ahead and tell me exactly what happened. And so they start with that. And then from there, a lot of the time is just asking the right questions to get them to hear themselves, you know, to kind of process, to kind of help them string together their own thoughts, their own feelings as to what happened. And so I think that's like the really big introductory part of this process. And then from there, you know, trying to figure out, you know, how you can maybe help them move forward. But a big part of this is not to be tempted into trying to, you know, have a silver bullet, you know, trying to just have a one swoop solution that's going to fix their problem, because oftentimes it's not what's going to happen. It's a process. You know, you might have to meet with them several times. At least if you can get them out of your office feeling like they're not crazy, feeling that God has not abandoned them. If I can accomplish those things, at least at the onset, then I've really, you know, started something that we can work with in the future.
Yeah. I came across an interesting note. Sociologist Phil Zuckerman wrote that faith is a deliberate act. And when social structures are in place that make faith plausible, such as when one is surrounded by like-minded believers or in their church, their congregation, whatnot, then faith may feel kind of, you know, taken for granted. But when these supportive structures are not in place, a crisis of faith can develop. And it more likely results in a loss of faith because there's a larger effort to maintain faith. There has to be a larger effort to maintain faith when you're alone. It's more burdensome. It's easier when you're surrounded by people that are like-minded. Does that make sense to you?
Yeah, I mean, that goes all the way back to the book of Genesis in the Bible, where, you know, God creates Adam, he creates the first man. And then one of the next thing he says is, it is not good for man to be alone. And whether he says the man or just man in general, either one is correct. It is not good for man to be alone.
So, you know, you brought up Genesis, but, you know, there's a better story in the Bible, the book of Job. I think if we can touch on that for a minute,
that's
probably the best known account of crisis of faith. Do you want to go into
that a little bit? Yeah, definitely. I mean, Job is, gosh, you're right. I mean, when people go through a crisis of faith, you know, that's often one of the stories that that is easily relatable. You know, and just in brief, the story of Job is he's a very righteous man. He's very wealthy, actually. He has many children. He has lots and lots of livestock. I mean, just the numbers of livestock he has is really astounding, you know, even for that time period. And so what happens is you see Satan, but in the book of Job, he's referred to really as the enemy, or what's, there's another word for it, or the prosecutor. In a way, Satan kind of stands as a prosecutor in court. He's trying to get you to fall. He's trying to accuse the accuser. That's normally what he's referred to as, is the accuser. And so he goes up to God and says, I'm willing to bet that if you strike Job, that he will curse you to your face. And God says, let it be done. Let him be tested. And so literally everything is taken from Job. And then what happens is Job's three friends come and kind of assist him in the grieving and the mourning process. You know, but the one thing that Job never does, he does ask some questions, but he never curses God. He's never accusatory at God, you know, and what happens is God reminds him in this episode of God's omnipotence, of his omniscience, you know, that the fact that he's all powerful, the fact that he's all knowing. And in the end, and Job is actually quite a long book in the Old Testament. In the end, Job is not only restored to what he had before, what he has after the whole catastrophe, the whole crisis is greater than what he had than when he started.
Yeah. Yeah. Many have strengthened faith after exactly. Reconsidering what they've gone through.
Right.
Yeah. 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 That's a great story. I definitely wanted to touch on that. And there are so many, so many other points of that story. It's really brutal in so many ways, this test that he went through. But yeah. Yeah. I want to move over to kind of large scale crises of faith throughout history. I've got a couple of points I pulled here that I wanted to discuss and just kind of maybe address these one by one. So I think one of the first ones I want to kick off with that was a huge, at least religious world event, was Martin Luther experienced a deep anguish that led him to break away from the Catholic Church, writing that he hated and was angry with God. And the resulting Protestant Reformation caused religious doubts throughout Europe as Catholics and Protestants called each other's views into question. This is a huge, large-scale crisis of faith, I would say, right?
Oh, absolutely. And it's funny you mentioned that. I was just thinking about that in the last couple of days. I remember watching a documentary recently, and I think it was actually on Netflix, about the life of Martin Luther. You know, and Martin Luther was an Augustinian friar. He was a monk. He was a priest. But it seemed like what he struggled with was really this sense of scrupulosity. Yeah, I know. And Amber talks a lot about scrupulosity as well in a lot of her content. But Martin Luther struggled seemingly a lot with scrupulosity, this fact that he perhaps was not good enough, you know, and I think that's kind of what led to him, you know, to his theology, especially his interpretations of Romans, which he kind of adds the word faith alone, that we are justified by faith alone. In fact, actually, this just came up as the reading for morning prayer. I think it was yesterday. And so that's kind of what he's dealing with. He's dealing with this kind of sense of, I guess, disgust with himself, perhaps this sense of feeling inadequate or just not good enough, and perhaps getting angry with God that, you know, perhaps that the rules maybe of the church were just overbearing, or, you know, and there had to be, I guess, maybe an easier way or a simpler way. And so I think a lot of it was just this perspective. He couldn't get out of his own head in a way.
Yeah. Yeah. And it caused a huge split.
A huge split is certainly an understatement. I mean, we're talking about probably it began the greatest fracturing of Christianity in its entire history. You know, I mean, at first it was just the East and the West, you know, you had the Latin West Church and you had the Greek speaking East, you know, but when you have the Reformation, you know, you look at how the Reformation has split, you know, after the East-West Schism, you didn't have that much more splintering, you know, but when you look at the Reformation itself, it was such a radical departure from either the Orthodox or Catholic theologies at the time, that now there's over 26,000 recognized Protestant denominations. So, and there's more and more each year as somebody kind of has their own idea or their own spin on things, you know, or their own interpretation of things. It began the largest fracturing of Christianity.
Yeah, for sure. Moving on to just other things. In the Victorian era, because of scientific discoveries conflicting with a literal reading of the Bible, of the book of Genesis, and the development of higher criticisms of the Bible, many Victorians felt that traditional religion had come into conflict with science during their lifetimes, impacting their family relationships, friendships, and public morality. What do you think about that?
Yeah, I mean, that comes up a lot, especially with the Catholic Church. And I've mentioned this even in my book. You know, I mentioned the relationship for the Catholic Church between faith and science, you know. And part of this is that we really don't see Genesis as a literal play-by-play. And one of the reasons for that is because you have to remember who wrote Genesis. Moses. Moses was not alive at the time of Adam and Eve. So how could Moses be this kind of, you know, person watching as a spectator if the first two humans were Adam and Eve, right? So there's a lot of things we have to just look at from a literary perspective and just be straight up honest with ourselves to say, okay, well, wait, well, who wrote Genesis? And if they weren't the first human being, then who's writing it? You know, so and it's very simple and straightforward, you know, so a lot of this, and there's even if you look in Genesis, there's two creation accounts. There's one that refers to Adam and Eve by name, and that's really the second account. The first account is really kind of more of an objective. This is the order of created things, you know? And so a lot of the time you have a very fundamentalist view from many Protestants where, you know, I even saw somebody post this on their Facebook page the other day. They think that that there's this a Christian martial arts group that part of their statement of faith is you have to believe that you know that Genesis is a literal play-by-play of how creation worked out, you know, that you can't have any kind of like scientific theories of like evolution or even intelligent design or things of that nature. It's like, okay, come on, like this is very simple rationalization to actually, you know, establish truth from myth as to literary devices, who wrote it, you know, this is very simple stuff.
Yeah. Well, Father Dan, we have a special guest popping in right now.
I know. I saw her pop in, her name pop in on the list right here. So what's
the religious hippies here with us?
Hey.
Hi. I'm sick, but I wanted to pop on because I miss you guys and I like talking about stuff.
Too.
Well, I thought I'd get you in here real quick, Amber, because originally you were going to be the other party to this topic. And I just thought I'd see if you wanted to pop in and just say something. We're talking about crisis of faith.
I feel that.
Have you ever experienced this?
Yeah. I mean, when I first came back into my faith, for like a whole year, I was on like cloud nine. I was going to daily mass. I wasn't struggling. I was going to confession, you know, monthly. And I had a really good faith life. And then all of a sudden, I kind of got hit with desolation probably like a year and a half into reverting or coming back into my faith. And that just like knocked me off my feet. And honestly, I'm still kind of recovering from it a little bit.
Wow. What do you think about that, Father Dan?
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. A lot of people, when they, you know, first have a conversion experience, it's oftentimes like a spiritual high, you know, and things seem to be going very hunky-dory and very well, you know, and then for the new convert, oftentimes the first crisis of faith is the most important one. It's the most crucial one in terms of, will they sink or swim? You know, will this kind of newfound faith actually help to sustain them? Or is it really more something of a numbing agent in a way, you know? And so that happens a lot. And I've seen a lot of people who had these kind of spiritual highs, these seeming conversion moments, but it wasn't authentic. It was very fleeting. And so trials is really what tempers our faith. You know, we hear that in the Book of Wisdom, you know, the souls of the just are in the hand of God, and he proves them as gold is tried in the furnace, you know. And so crisis in faith really is what helps us as Christians to strengthen our faith. That makes a lot of sense.
Yeah. For sure. Amber, we're in the middle of talking about just some historical events that, spurred some crisis of faith. So you kind of came in the middle of some of these. So I'm going to, you're welcome to offer your input on any of this. But the next one I want to cover is the Second World War. After the mass killings of the Second World War, Holocaust theology had to contend with a God who apparently allowed or caused such devastation and the resulting widespread crisis of faith. Do you all want to touch on that? When you see something like this type, this level of catastrophe happen, as you know, starting with you, Father Dan, as a priest, what do you say to people? How do you justify a God that would let this happen?
I mean, this is the thing, you know, whether it be Judaism or Christianity, you know, because really, in a sense, Christians, we have our origin from Judaism. Jesus, it's not like he came to establish a new religion. He said he came to fulfill the old. There's always going to be persecution. And that's the thing is, at least from a Christian perspective, we often recognize persecution as a sign that in many ways we're on the right track, you know, that God is actually with us, you know. Because Jesus said the entire time, like, the world will hate us because of him. Now, at the same time, you know, Jews, at least at the time of World War II, most of them didn't recognize Jesus as the Messiah. But certainly, you know, because of their religion, because of their observance and in many ways, strict observance of their faith, was seen as opposing the world and worldly values, perhaps in a sense, standing in the way of progress for many people who want to see certain outcomes, and oftentimes religious people are seen as hindrances to progress. And I think the universal principle behind that is because for us as religious people, we recognize universal and immutable truths, that is, truths that are unchanging, you know. And because Judaism is one of the oldest modern world religions, I think that certainly came to a head with World War II.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, I think when people hear about, you know, natural disasters or genocides or even mass casualty situations like school shooters, I think many people start to immediately question how could a God allow this? Almost daily, we're seeing these mass shooter news stories. Let's dig into that for a minute. And I'd like to hear from both of you on this, you know, your feelings on it. Do you think a lot of people correlate this to these people that are the shooters just being evil? And that brings us to a concept of good and evil. Do you think people are pulling away from the idea that a God couldn't let this happen? Like, from a religious perspective, give me your feelings on this.
Yeah, I think what happens is, you know, as society becomes more and more godless, you know, the more that society becomes, I guess you could say, secularized and wanting nothing to do with God, the more they will actually try to point the finger at God if he did in fact exist, you know, in their minds, to say, well, a good God wouldn't let this happen, you know. But that's the thing, is the more we turn away from God, the worse our society has become. You know, that now the family itself is undermined, you know, the fact that we were born into family and we need family to actually not just survive, but to thrive. And so when we destroy the human family, that leads to situations where people have messed up lives. And that's where we often see these shooters come in from, you know, or, you know, especially with that kind of tragedy, you know. And so this really goes back to the question of free will. You know, that God gives people choices. He loves people so much. He loves us so much that he gives us the choice, you know, and if we so much as choose to turn away from him and to commit evil, he gives us that choice, because love implies the choice to love. You know, God doesn't force us to love him. If he forced us, it wouldn't be love. And so we have to realize that love really is a double-edged sword. Love can heal, but love also hurts. And they really do kind of go hand in hand.
Yeah. Amber, do you have a comment on that?
Yeah. I mean, I would say that, you know, in the world we live in, it's always kind of been this, you know, crazy kind of people killing people type thing. And it's really sad to think about. But something that I think about a lot is that without hardship, we can't have you know, joy in a sense. You know, if we don't have stress, we can't, or if we don't have something to be afraid of, we can't show courage. And so I think of it in that mindset where bad times do create strong people and it brings communities together. And, you know, bad times are definitely, and, you know, we don't want those, but they're going to happen because, you know, we're sinful in nature. And so that's something that I like to just keep in the back of my head. I know it's not as in depth as Father Dan's answer, but I don't have the whole priest side of things, but I definitely think that that's how I keep kind of going with it, you know?
You know, just, I don't want to get too far off the main topic, but I do want to bring up, you know, one thing about the school shooters, and I'm curious of your opinions on this. If we go back to kind of the original school shooting, Columbine, you know, those kids, those, although the motives even to this day are still unclear why the two shooters did what they did, there was a lot of evidence during the shooting that they singled out people that treated them badly. They went after the cliques of the kids that picked on them. And a lot of, there's a lot of people that believe that that shooting was motivated by the bullying that they had. But if you look at Sandy Hook, where that shooter singled out little kids, kindergartners, first graders, second graders, the madness in a mind that of a person that could kill a child seems much different. Do you have an opinion on whether this is, are there levels of evil? Is this a much more evil person than, say, what the kids did in Colorado? Does that make sense, Father Dan?
I mean, I'm thinking in terms of, you know, like mortal versus venial sin. To me, in either case, you know, that you certainly have the grave matter for mortal sin. Now, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong. The Sandy Hook shooting was somebody who was on the spectrum or special needs. Or no,
I'm not sure about that. I don't know.
Yeah. At least the grave matter is certainly present. I mean, that's, you're talking still about, you know, the taking of human life. And there's really, you know, unless for the purposes of self-defense, which, you know, I'm very big on, you know, anything besides that, there really is no justification for taking a human life. And so in those instances, you really do have to, I wouldn't say that there are even differences in degrees of evil for that, for those two cases. To me, they fall into the same category of evil, that this was gravely, evil, at least by the matter, the grave matter that was committed.
Hmm. What about you, Amber? Do you think there's worse kinds of evils? Does it take a worse kind of person to kill a child versus killing an adult?
I agree with Father Dan and what he said. I know that, you know, you go between venial versus mortal sin, but, you know, killing someone in general is really bad. That's mortal. And I mean, I definitely think killing children is, you know, awful. I mean, we see it in abortion all the time, right? I mean, that's terrible. But at the same time, like, I mean, it's kind of hard to answer because it depends on the, like, where that person was in their mindset and things too. And I remember hearing about this when I was a kid. I don't remember when Sandy Hook happened. I think it was 2012, maybe.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think we're on an anniversary of it now.
I thought it happened in December, but no, I could be wrong. I don't really know, but I do remember reading up about it for a presentation, and you know, the Adam Lanza, he was the guy who was the shooter, and he, it's interesting because usually when you hear about school shootings and things like that, it's because of mental health issues or because of, you know, something along those lines. And with Lanza, it's like he was never actually diagnosed with anything. He definitely talked about like a lot of mental health issues and stuff. And so I'm not exactly sure where mental health and all that stuff plays a role in it, but it is still mortal. And I think God is a just judge and he gives people what is due.
Yeah, yeah. You know, the reason why I wanted to, you know, steer off into this direction is, you know, this person this guy, Adam Lanza, caused the crisis of faith with parents of the victims that were there. So you're seeing it from that other end, what the cause is, you know? So I think so much of this crisis of faith is cause and effect, where you have to go with this. Another historical event I want to get into, because this relates directly to the Catholic Church, and I'm curious of Father Dan's opinion on it, is Rwanda. So leaders of the Catholic Church in Rwanda did not stand in the way, of a million people getting murdered during the 1994 Rwandan genocide. And this includes thousands of victims that were hiding inside of church buildings as a place of refuge. The United Nations believes that Catholic priests even participated in the killings. This is absurd to me to even hear this. And many Rwandans refused to return to worship services, and it caused a widespread crisis of faith in Rwanda. Reporters spoke to Rwandans who lost conviction in the church because they saw that church-going people were fully capable of great evil. Let's jump into this, Father Dan. Do you think, so a lot of this is a propaganda spin? Do you think this was real? Catholic Church genocide? I know when World War II, there wasn't a lot from the Vatican on what was going on in Germany. Can we speak to that for a moment?
Yeah, so I don't think it's not propaganda at all, because it's ironic you mentioned this. I was just reading an article the other day that there was a priest from, I believe it was Rwanda, who during the genocide, you're right, either maybe not actively participated, but certainly enabled the genocide to take place. And he was actually, I don't understand why it took so long, but he was finally laicized. He was stripped of his public ministry, and he was actually defrocked as a penalty by the Holy See. And so obviously what that says is that, no, it wasn't propaganda, that this actually happened, you know. And as far as especially Pope Pius XII in World War II, I think a big thing we have to remember is the fact that for most of the war, Rome was in fascist Italy. You know, and so, yeah. And there's a great movie that kind of shows the relationship between the Holy See and the fascist, and that's The Scarlet and the Black, and it's about the Monsignor who was, I think, the Secretary of State or something along those lines of the Vatican, and you see the Pope struggle with, you know, he wishes he could say more, but at the same time, you know, he's trying not to paint a target on his back for the papacy, because he's behind enemy lines, if you want to put it that way. You know, every pope after him would also have a target on their back. And so in many ways, what the church did during World War II was any kind of humanitarian aid that they granted, especially to Jews, was a lot of it was underground. You know, it's not that the Vatican was absolutely silent on the evil that was occurring. A lot of it was that it just had to work very quietly towards the good.
Right, right. And a crisis of faith doesn't always just come from situations like this. It can come from things like epidemics. And of course, we saw a lot of crisis of faith during COVID. You talked about that earlier in the episode, but the Liberians faced a crisis of faith during the Ebola virus epidemic from 2014 to 2015. But what was interesting about this particular crisis of faith was the Pentecostal churches denied the existence of the disease. Where we've heard this before, denying the existence of the disease, and that led to increased death. And the Liberia Council of Churches called Ebola divine punishment for homosexuality and government corruption. You want to talk about that for a second, what your feelings are on this?
Oh boy. I tend to be very skeptical of over-spiritualizing things. And that tends to happen a lot, is you see people many people I think are trying to prove a point, and they will take whatever evidence they can to prove that point. And I think you saw that a lot with COVID as well, that people said, well, this is, you know, God's scourge on humanity. And I don't quite think that's the case, not to that extreme, you know. And so I think that people need to kind of, you know, pump the brakes a bit, you know. And can it be an opportunity for conversion? Absolutely. But was that the cause? Like, did God send this to smite us? You know, it sounds very much like the Old Testament, you know, how God, you know, would flood the earth, you know, and things of that nature. And, you know, but this is, I think that is certainly an over-spiritualization if they said, well, this is, you know, God punishing us for, because these sins are happening all around the world, you know? And so if like for Ebola, you know, in Liberia, like that's not just localized sins, I guess you could say localized evils. A lot of those things are happening on an even grander scale, you know, in the West. And so I think it's very important for us not to over-spiritualize things.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. You know, during the just kind of going back to the pandemic again, you know, the pandemic with the lockdowns and closures of things, you know, kids were doing, they weren't going to schools, restaurants were closed, people were staying home, people were losing their jobs, being laid off, even churches, you couldn't go to church, like, which to me is still absurd. I still argue this all the time. And I think this will be something in the courts for many, many years, how churches could be closed and not be considered an essential service. You and I have talked about this many, many times on different episodes.
Oh yeah.
But, but when you strip so much away from a person, their ability to have income, to go out and socialize, to even go out into the world, to do anything, you take away their jobs, you take away their money, you know, how can a person not have a crisis of faith if you are a spiritual person? But at the same time, I'm not sure if these people think because they believe in a God, the road should be paved in gold, like everything is supposed to come to them. And I just, you know, I wonder how you can explain that to people. Do you understand what I'm trying to say? Like, is that what they think? Is it supposed to be smooth sailing because you believe in God?
Maybe not smooth sailing, but certainly we are expected to have a certain degree of courage, you know? And I think that that's what these moments, these crises of faith, you know, challenge us to do. And God certainly can use them for this purpose. And that's simply to build our confidence, to build our trust in Him. You know, that even in the midst of dark times, you know, I mean, this goes back to when Jesus tells Peter, you know, upon this rock, I will build my church and the gates of hell shall not prevail against it. You know, so yes, the gates of hell will come up against us, but it won't win. That being said, we will encounter the gates of hell, you know, so I think we have to be prepared for challenges and prepared for trials, you know, and oftentimes it's events like COVID that, you know, certainly separate the weeds from the wheat. Or the sheep from the goats, you know, all these parables we hear Jesus talk about with separating those who were prepared and those who were righteous versus those who were unprepared and those who were not righteous. You know, that's a big theme that we see in the Gospels as well, is that the Lord is constantly using challenges and crises to see who is prepared, who has lived their entire life as if they could meet their maker any day. And who has just kind of put it off and said, well, I'm going to live to a ripe old age and that's it. And then, you know, they die in a car accident very young and they weren't actually ready, you know? Yeah. So again, God can certainly use these things to test us and not because He's doing this to be mean, but because He's legitimately trying to strengthen us.
Right. Right. So I want to, as I wrap this episode up, I want to ask you both just, you know, a quick couple of sentences on what to do. If you encounter a friend or just anyone who is starting to suffer a crisis of faith, they're starting to doubt something, what advice do you give them? What do they do first?
I think for me, it depends exactly what the crisis is. You know, I'd certainly, like I mentioned at the beginning, you know, ask them, tell me what you're thinking, tell me what you're feeling. Because again, it's not like a one fits all solution. I think what I would tell them is you need to keep talking about this. You need to not bottle it up. I think that would be the first thing I would say. That tends to be a common first step, is for them to at least, you know, relate it to somebody. You know, I understand that they may be angry at God. They may be hesitant to go to God with that. And that's okay. I think that's to be expected in some cases. But at least they need to be relating it to somebody. And then for us to offer to be that person they can relate it to, you know, to be open to hearing their story, to hearing their pains, you know, and as much as possible to try to redirect them to God.
Yeah. And that's an interesting perspective. And coming from a priest and from Amber, what do you think? If you have a friend that says, hey, I'm struggling here, I'm not sure how I feel about God, what do you tell them?
Yeah, I definitely agree with what Father Dan said. I'm a layperson, so I can only offer so much guidance in a certain struggle. I know people who have dealt with, you know, deaths. I know people who have dealt with just simply doubting the truth of the church. And normally what I do is I do my best to just listen. I do my best to just hear them out and see where they're coming from and acknowledge that, you know, I mean, their feelings are probably valid in the way that they're feeling. But a lot of the times the issues that they're dealing with are outside of my expertise. So I will usually try to put them in contact with a priest or a trusted friend that I know who's actually skilled, you know, who's a therapist or something in that nature. And I ask them, I'm like, would you be willing, you know, to talk to this person about that? Because I also think we need to point them in the direction of, you know, somebody, because if we tell them like, oh, you need to talk to somebody about this or something, sometimes they don't choose the best sources. Sometimes they will choose sources that are dangerous, you know, to their faith and will cause an even bigger crisis in their faith. And so that's why I usually try to point them towards a priest or a sister. And I'm in contact with quite a few. And so I try to reach out to them and give them those resources. But honestly, I think a lot of times people just need someone to listen. Somebody who's not going to be like, oh, here's the instant antidote to that. You know, here's exactly what you should be doing in order to fix that. I think, you know, we have a lot of that these days where people just want their problems fixed, but too many people don't actually fix the root of the problem. And so I think we really need to offer that support and help and be that person for them if we can, and if not, point them in the direction of somebody who will be able to do that for them in the Catholic sphere.
Yeah. Yeah. I like that. It's a great answer. Well, you two, I really appreciate your input on this. I hope we gave the listeners something to think about with this, especially if you're out there going through a crisis of faith. But a great interview, really appreciate it. Father Dan, I know it's going to get harder to get you in the future as you go active duty, but we're going to try and do these as often as we can, I hope.
Yeah, by the time this comes out, I'll probably be in Alaska. So.
Yeah.
Can I throw in one last little thing for people?
Sure.
So for the Uganda,
Rwanda, yeah.
Rwanda. For that, if people are struggling with a crisis of faith, I highly suggest they look up this woman who survived the Rwanda genocide. Her name is Immaculee. It's Immaculee. I can't pronounce her last name, but it's
Ilibagiza.
Yeah, thank you.
Ilibagiza. Yes, I've heard her speak in person. She's fantastic. Wonderful. Yes.
She survived in, I believe it was a 3x4 foot bathroom for months with 7 other women. And she survived by praying the rosary. She prayed 27 rosaries every single day. I actually got the chance to go see her speak at NCYC in 2019. So if you guys
were at the same place.
What? I feel like I knew that. That's so funny. Yeah. But you guys should definitely check out her story.
Yes. That's where I heard
her. You didn't know each other, but you were at the same event?
Yep. This was a year before we met.
That's so funny.
Wow. I never knew that. That's incredible.
Oh, that's so funny. You got to see her speak too? Because her story is fantastic.
Yeah, that's exactly where I heard her speak.
Catholic Register.
Yep.
Wow. Anyways, I just wanted to throw that out there if anyone wanted some, you know, hope for, you know, that area. I don't know. Anyways.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Well, so Amber, when this episode comes out, it'll be the fall of the year. It's my season 5, of course.
Aww.
And your prayer group will still be going on when this comes out. So tell everyone about your prayer group that don't already know about it and just sort of how they can find you out there in the interwebs.
Yeah. So I'm the religious hippie and you guys can find me on almost every social media platform under that handle. And I run the St. Jude prayer group. It's a prayer group that's dedicated to praying for people who are lapsed Catholics, people who are doubting their faith or having a crisis of faith. There are people just honestly anyone and everyone who is struggling with their faith. And so I have this prayer group. We meet on Zoom every week, and you can find the information for that on my website under the events tab. So it's thereligioushippie.com. And under the events tab, you'll see prayer group. Just click on that. It'll have the dates and times we're meeting. It has the sign up, because you do have to sign up, and it's free. But we pray for each other. We have intentions. We have community. And it's just, it's wonderful. So I highly suggest popping on if you have the chance.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that that's going to go for probably another month.
Yes.
And then do we know, did you decide if you're going to do a book club for the fall or not? Should
Yes, we did. We decided yes.
Okay, great, great, great. And yeah. Then make sure you visit Amber's website, because she's got a lot of really cool donation items on there.
Yeah, it's really fun.
That you can look at. So definitely. And Father Dan, you want to tell everyone how they can find you out there on the interwebs?
Yes. So I am at The Karate Priest on Instagram, or I think it's called The Karate Priest Podcast is the full name on Instagram. We also have a Facebook page, The Karate Priest. And then besides that, my book is now available. You could find it at Amazon or Barnes and Noble's online. It is called Jesus in the Dojo. I really encourage you to buy it, give it a read. If you like it, leave a review. That being said, please pray for me as I am now making the transition to active duty Air Force.
Yeah. So hopefully we get a season 3 of the Karate Priest podcast would be great, but we got to wait and see what your schedule looks like to see if we can do it.
Yeah, definitely. Especially, you know, I'll be 3 hours behind what I currently am now. So I'll probably be 4 hours behind you, Todd. So we'll see how that timing.
Oh, that's okay. You guys know I don't sleep. Come on.
Yeah, you get like 3 hours and that's it.
Yep.
I don't sleep much. But yeah, we have to see how the internet connection is going to be to Alaska.
I don't know. Sure. Right now in Houma, it's not that good. So we'll see.
One extreme to another. Yep. Also, just so you know, one thing we didn't mention with the book, people can actually get autographed copies of the book through Metacortex Publishing. So go to the publishing website, because we do have autographed copies of Father Dan's book there. But like Amber says, with all that being said, which is how she ends all her episodes, all in the same way.
I do that.
I appreciate everyone listening.
Yeah, if I don't. Yeah.
For sure. And with all that being said, we will wrap this one up, and I'll see you guys next time, okay?
Thank you for listening to this podcast. Please be sure to rate and review this episode. This podcast is produced by Todd Fisher and Anthony Smith and is distributed by Metacortex Publishing. This podcast is copyright. Any previously trademarked or copyright content is used by permission. Information and opinions stated in this podcast should not be construed as medical advice. Please be sure to visit the official website for Metacortex Publishing at metacortexpublishing.com, or find us on social media for other unique content.